The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Kalayla Williams, and I direct the Free Library of Philadelphia's One Book, One Philadelphia program. In 2016, One Book is discussing the ramifications of U.S. slavery, and to that end, I'd like to encourage you to mark your calendars for the One Book finale on March 30th at 7:30 p.m. here at the Parkway Central Library, which will feature authors Edward Ball of Slaves and the Family, Paul Beatty of The Sellout, and Laureen Carey of Black Ice. Flyers are available on the table outside. And it is this fraught and burdened landscapes of race and legacy that tie together tonight's readers, Daryl Pinkney of the novel Black Deutschland and Margot Jefferson of the memoir Negroland. Jed of Black Deutschland is on the fringes of society. Gay, black, having struggled with addiction, he flees from Chicago to what he believes is a city of paradise and promise, Berlin. But in spite of the distance he covers, both temporal and spatial, he can neither escape history nor his future and in the fears and failure that might reside therein. Publishers Weekly writes, Pinkney's novel is a lively, inviting, and beautifully written story of survival by intellect. Daryl Pinkney is the author of a novel, High Cotton, as well as two books of nonfiction, Blackballed, The Black Vote, and U.S. Democracy, and Out There, Mavericks of Black Literature. He is a longtime contributor to the New York Review of Books and a recipient of the Harold D. Versal Memorial Award for Distinguished Prose from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. The New York Times writes of Margot Jefferson, there's sinew and grace in the way that she plays with memory, dodging here and there and burning like a photographer in a dark room. Negroland is the story of a girl turned woman in the world of America's black elite. The daughter of a physician and a socialite, Jefferson learned from a very early age the importance of gloved hands, pressed hair, stylish hats, and skin lighter than a paper bag. This world of being the right kind of black folk, exclusive and yet excluded, is what Margot Jefferson confronts with the candid eye of a literary critic. Jefferson won a Pulitzer Prize in 1995 for her book reviews in the New York Times, and her work has appeared in Newsweek, New York Magazine, Vogue, Harper's, and other works, and she's the author of a book of nonfiction on Michael Jackson. She is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and other accolades. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Daryl Pinkney and Margot Jefferson.
Thank you very much for that, and I am glad to be here. I'm going to read a section about what it was like in the 50s to watch for black families, or a black family like mine and many, to watch with this fraught anticipation of our entertainers, the ones who were carrying the weight of expectation, stereotype, fighting against it, carrying that weight in the black press, in the white press, and at a time when television and the movies were, let's say, rigorously racially patrolled. Yes, exactly. Segregated to patrolled, you know, meaning you'd get a scene here or whatever there. So we were always very aware of even the tiny little shades of patronization or acknowledgement that all the details of performance and theater, in theater as well as movies, meant. So this is set in the 50s. My sister's name is Denise. Denise is in our parents' bedroom at mother's vanity dresser. She tries on earrings and necklaces. She hazards a provocative smile. She puts her right elbow on the glass-covered dresser top and places her chin in her hand, her ballet class hand, soft but alert, slightly rounded. Before dinner, she will ask, "Who do I look more like, Lena Horne or Dorothy Dandridge?" I am listening to records. Guys and Dolls, The King and I, Oklahoma. I perform rake bravado, soubrette whimsy, judicious womanliness. The beautiful young lieutenant from mainline Philadelphia has found himself in love with a beautiful brown-skinned girl in the South Pacific. She is Polynesian and speaks no English. We know, though the rest of America may not, that Juanita Hill, who plays her mother, is really a Negro. The lieutenant has learned a lesson I already know, a lesson he sings about with the fearless legato insistence of the wholly sheltered. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made. Singing along, I make the oddly more staccato and I curl my lip. His, and people whose skin is a different shade, is earnest and impassioned. I keep the passion, but mute the earnestness with a raised eyebrow. It's weekend television time. Sammy Davis Jr. is going to be on the Milton Berle Show. Dorothy Dandridge is going to be on the Jerry Lewis Colgate Hour. Lena Horne is going to be on the Frank Sinatra Timex Show. These are seminal moments in the viewing mores of the nation. After dinner, the four of us gather in the TV room. Our parents are on the couch. Denise and I push the hassocks as near to the TV as we can, or stretch out on the floor until we're told to sit up straight. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome. Sammy Davis Jr. does a swing run onto the stage. He wears a taut, close-fitting suit and rectangular black-framed glasses. My parents saw him live in New York. My father, he can do it all. My mother, he certainly can. Pause. He still has too much oil in his hair. They've talked about how men in show business tend to use too much oil or oil that's too thick. These men don't always use stocking caps either, which settles the hair into ridge waves that don't have to pretend to be straight. Sammy can dance beautifully and sing very well. He enunciates crisply with no trace of a stock Negro accent. He imitates the racially neutral vocal stylings of Nat King Cole and Billy Daniels and the racially white vocal stylings of Cary Grant, James Stewart, and James Cagney. This is cheeky and very satisfying. Daddy sits back on the couch. We hear him chuckle. Mother leans forward eagerly and taps her cigarette into the aquamarine glass ashtray. Sammy isn't on his own, though. Not yet. He is followed on stage by two quiet, portly, balding men. He is still tethered to his father, Sammy Davis Sr., and the kind employer of his childhood, whom he still calls Uncle Will. He is still part of the Will Mastin trio. He's carrying them along, Mother comments impatiently. The older men have the generic smiles of vaudeville second stringers who learned years ago how to frame the star, keep time, recede, do their specialty step, recede, and exit from stage and memory. They speak with mild and genial Negro accents. They're from an age before television, before Broadway theaters like Ed Sullivan's, where cheerful white people sat, eager to be entertained, before TV rec rooms, before dens, where Negro families sat, waiting to be entertained and hoping not to be denigrated. Will Mastin and Sammy Davis Sr. are folk art before folk art becomes museum-worthy. It's time for them to go, my father says in a gentle, definite way. Lena Horne's nostrils flare. They do not spread. The bridge of her nose is thin and exact. The nose of Dorothy Dandridge is a little bit fuller, but it's not full. And she has a dimple right above her lips, Cupid's bow lips, maidenly lips. Lena's smile is wide, but her lips are not. She has high, wide Indian cheekbones, so she needs a wide smile. Her top lip is so narrow that she probably has trouble applying lipstick properly, like my grandmother. Lena and Dorothy can wear their hair any way they want, upswept with bangs and tendrils like Jennifer Jones, shoulder length with wave clusters like Elizabeth Taylor, trimmed to a cap of wayward curls like Ava Gardner, who's from the South and may have black blood. They look glamorous. They look comfortable in evening gowns and fur stoles. like Mother and her friends, but most people don't know we Negroes dress like that. Dorothy Dandridge sits in a studio set apartment. When a woman sings on a television show, she's supposed to be singing in her cute living room or her frilly boudoir. There's a window frame with curtains behind her. She's waiting for her gentleman friend. She can peer into a mirror and pout. She can perch on a small cushion seat and kick her legs up. She can fling herself onto a love seat. She can pick up a real poodle when the song ends and hug it coquettishly. Dorothy Dandridge wears a pale, ruffled ball gown in her single miss apartment. She has put her hair in a society hostess bun with a center part, and there are four strands of pearls around her neck. She looks down as if she's misbehaved, then lifts her head and smiles. "Blow out the candle," she sings pertly. "Blow out the candle. Won't you blow out the candle so the neighbors won't see?" She cups her hands at her waist, clasps them at her throat. Opera singers always do this on TV. Throws her head back just a bit and smiles again. She extends an arm, then flings it up and flicks her wrist. It's almost Spanish. Her shoulders move slightly, no more than a few measures, and off the beat. Then she sways her hips, pretending not to notice their swaying. "Just enough," says my mother. She mimes snuffing out a candle like French maids do in operas. "Won't you blow out the candle so there will be no scandal and no one will know you've been kissing me?" Why couldn't they give her a real song, Ellington, or a show tune, my father wants to know. He doesn't want to know, he knows, and we know too. She did the best she could with that ditty. Oh, but Lena Horne has made her way into the show tune penthouse. Lena Horne sings Cole Porter. She's wearing a black sheath with full-length see-through sleeves. The white curtains behind her curl and drape, while tearing off a game of golf. Ha. My father doesn't care about golf, but plenty of his friends do. The collar of her sheath is made of tulle netting, and it matches the cuffs. Tulle ruffles cuff her wrists. Lena Horne doesn't move her body at all. She stands in profile the whole time. Her behind is perfectly round, not big. One arm is poised at her waist, the other moves stealthily towards the fancy chair that goes with the vanity dresser that isn't on the set. She places her wrist on the chair back with extreme care. Hauteur is my mother's word. She has ballet hands, but they're a little pointed. They're show business ballet hands. She lets two fingers touch the curve of the chair and move back and forth. I just adore his asking for more. This time the I is ah, while adore comes out, adore, and more, her eyes widen and stare out on more, rolls into more. The syllables stay crisp, though. They're not guttural. They're a design carved onto the surface of each word. She stretches her mouth open, widens it, and shows her teeth, even and gleaming in perfect formation. She smiles, but curls her lips as she sings, "But my heart belongs to Daddy." Then she turns her face away and lifts her chin. For the last line, "'Cause my daddy, he treats it so well," we see only her profile. My parents talk about what she does with her face. Lena does mug, they agree, but she can get away with it. She's a beauty. And she used to be bland. Then she married Lenny Hayden. He was a band leader and arranger, a big wheel at MGM. He gave her sophisticated arrangements and taught her how to put a song over with personality, with pizzazz, to rule it, not defer to it. Lenny Hayden is white, but when you see pictures of them in Ebony, he's the one who looks grateful. He's always smiling. He's standing behind her most of the time with his white hair and his little beard. Lena knew what she was doing. She never has the lapses in taste Dorothy Dandridge has. One night on Ed Sullivan, the curtains part to show Dorothy in a strapless gown that pushes her breasts up and toward each other and out toward the waiting audience. In a whispery voice, sometimes closing her eyes and sliding her head back toward undulating shoulders, she chants, He's a smooth operator, a cool sweet potato, and a gone alligator. I'm here to tell you one natural fact. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. I like it like that. You drive me wild. You make me shout. Have mercy, Mr. Percy. Now cut that out. Mercy, Mr. Percy, my mother repeats when Ed Sullivan has extended his hand, thanked Miss Dandridge, and gone to a commercial break. Why doesn't she just say master and sing it standing on an auction block? Everybody knows Dorothy Dandridge wants to marry a white man. She's never managed to turn a white lover into a loving husband, and she'll never stop trying. Everybody knows Otto Preminger won't marry her, though she hoped he would after he directed Carmen Jones and she became the first Negro woman to get an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress. Carmen was a wanton, which we resent seeing Negro women play, since most people think that's what Negro women are. But at least Carmen started out as a gypsy in a French opera. 2 years later, Dorothy Dandridge was supposed to play Tuptim in The King and I. Tuptim, the refined Burmese maiden pledged to the King of Siam by her ambitious father, yet loving the gently handsome Lun Ta, to whom she was first betrothed. But Dorothy Dandridge turned the role down. Tuptim was little more than a slave, she declared. And how the Negro establishment lauded her decision. So Dorothy Dandridge denied hundreds of Negro girls the chance to sit rapturously in a movie theater watching a Negro woman pad delicately across palace floors in oriental silk, turquoise, fuchsia, emerald green, and gold, voice sweetly chanting, eyes faintly slanted, and hair straight and dark as a raven's wing. Exquisite, chastely arousing, worthy of worship, anguish, and sacrifice, played instead by Puerto Rican Rita Moreno. What misbegotten scruples. The enthrallment of a beautiful Asian woman is not squalid. It is refined through ancient rituals of the Orient that white people must acknowledge despite their racial and cultural misgivings. We Negroes long for such an aura. When my school stages a musical revue that year that includes the March of the Siamese Children, I get to be one in red sateen, with a top knot, rouged cheeks, and lipstick, eyes drawn to a wide slant with the teacher's blunt makeup pencil. A year later, I watch the Japanese, Miko Taka, enchant Marlon Brando in Sayonara. He wants to marry her, and in the end he does. It's profoundly exciting. 2 years after The King and I, Dorothy Dandridge will be playing a Negro slave in Tamango and a drug-addled wanton in Porgy and Bess, torn between a brute, a pimp, and a crippled beggar. She will marry a white man no one has heard of, referred to in the Negro and white press as a restaurateur or a nightclub proprietor. My parents mock husbands of stars with undistinguished resumes. Usually they're described as their wives' managers. Jack Dennison runs some kind of restaurant in Las Vegas and will soon be opening one in Los Angeles, we're told. What kind of restaurateuring did he do before he met Dorothy Dandridge with her money and Hollywood connections? He'd never be able to get a white wife of her stature, would he? Thank you.
Well, why not follow Margot Jefferson? There are worse fates. Negroland is such a good book. And I'm very nervous, so I'm just going to go bleh, and then someone will say, time, or we've had enough, and I'll stop. Oh, gosh. It doesn't always start with the suitcase. Sometimes things begin with the wrong book. Berlin Meant Boys, Isherwood said. 50 years after his adventures among proletarian toughs, Berlin meant white boys who wanted to atone for Germany's crimes by loving a black boy like me. The first time I saw the Mercedes-Benz star revolving over Europa Center, West Berlin's triumphant commercial hub, I knew I was home. I had a room in a hotel near the main West Berlin station, the sort of place where burned-out hippies beat up their girlfriends. I didn't even turn on the light as I tossed in my bag. I hit the heavy-named streets, delight in my stride. You would have thought I'd arrived in Venice, but I'd read quite a bit about how the not-old-for-Europe structures of West Berlin, stripped of decoration, felt squeezed by the post-war functionalism of the here to replace what was unremembered. I pranced to the central shopping mall. West Berlin was the outpost of Western prosperity, the floating island of neon and pleasure deep inside communist territory. This was its core. I'd read that after the construction of the Berlin Wall, both sides wanted to distract their populations from the border cutting through the heart of the capital. Each side created its own new city center away from the wall. East Berlin had Alexanderplatz, dominated by the giant needle and revolving restaurant of a television tower visible for miles. West Berlin had Europa Center, a wall of steel and glass, a courtyard of shops and offices nestled beside an office tower, the only one of its kind in the city when erected in 1961. It blocked out, psychologically, the wall of mortar and wire that ran parallel along the same north-south axis, dividing east from west. The standing rectangle of office tower looked across the Tiergarten, a vast park that had become as quiet as no man's land because of its proximity to the wall. At any hour, the Tiergarten was filled with boys, silently cruising under the cover of post-war linden or chestnut trees. The tower block was grounded in a narrow plaza. The past sat on the shoulder of everything you saw in Berlin. The ruin of a Romanesque revival spire marked one end of the plaza, chiding the ugly modern octagon of beehive blue glass next to it that was built as the new church and also as a memorial to the old one. Had there been traffic, it would have flowed around this plaza. There the Kurfürstendamm begins, West Berlin's show street that makes a humorless diagonal through the city along the route Prussian kings took to their hunting lodges. In the middle of the plaza, a round fountain of big beige granite dollops is still running. My very first night in Berlin, the people hanging out around the fountain, young or just long-haired, looked like they'd met at the train station a few minutes before and had walked over to conclude unsavory transactions. Young couples, families of shoppers, and groups of moviegoers kept their distance, sitting under umbrellas at the beer, cola, and coffee tables at the other end of the plaza. The company emblem turned in the friendly sky. Behind the red Mercedes-Benz star, perfectly in line with it as I looped back around, was a pink August sun just beginning to quit. This was the start of the awful 1980s. I saved money from my second job, a telephone marketing gig, for the few weeks I could afford to spend in Berlin every summer. Just before Chicago flipped out because of AIDS terror, I was getting away, but every summer coming back too soon, broke and heartbroken over some kerchief bartender and feeling superior to everything about my hometown. I was leaving pieces of myself in Berlin, like a bird carrying its feathers one by one to a distant nest. In the Cold War days, Berlin was far away, a disco ball behind the Iron Curtain. I smoked menthols on bar stools, snorted lines in paperless stalls, and threw up on corners all over the near north side, protected by my dream of eventual escape. Though born in Chicago, I was just passing through. Whatever had happened in the Golden Rectangle, whatever was going down on the south side did not matter. I may have fallen apart in the city of my birth, but the city of my rebirth would see me put back together again. My real life of the happiness I deserved would begin once I got over there and stayed. What had not happened in Chicago would finally happen in Berlin, the city that owed me and loved my fantasies. I was idiotic during my first visit to Berlin. I bought drinks three nights running for a sour-smelling old man who told me he had inherited from his father the most rare footage in Europe, 27 seconds of Nijinsky dancing. Of course, the film was held in a bank. He'd invite me special to see it. It used to be Amez-vous Paris that the black GI ran to, my dad said, rolling slowly in his chair up to and back from his desk. But you and your cousin can't get enough of that Sprechensee jive. I didn't tell him that because I'd been in a bar all day, I'd snore through the Berlin Philharmonic concert that my cousin had taken me to. I forgave before anyone else did the young blind prowler I had been, who drank as though Weimar culture could be got through the bottle. After those few summers of desperate rehearsal, tourist make-believe, I was recently sober and alone in a train compartment about to be locked tight for the border crossing between the fast-driving exhibitionist German Federal Republic and the paranoid German Democratic Republic with its harsh fuels. I'd left Chicago behind for good. I was inordinately proud of my one-way ticket. I'd become that person I so admired, the black American expatriate. Branches of the same people who are black in the valley are white on the mountain, Frederick Douglass said. The beautiful hair of the Nubian becomes frizzled as he approaches the Great Sahara, he added. Mad, unknowable people were hijacking planes over Europe and setting off bombs at the Frankfurt International Airport the summer I came back to West Berlin ready for adult life, willing to register with the police. My new job came with what I considered glamorous international paperwork. The address I was going to wasn't far, and I could nod to the Mercedes-Benz star. I always let it know when I was back in town as the taxi turned in the opposite direction onto the Kurfürstendamm. The city arched its back in the sandy heat. My cousin Cello and her husband and their four children and a nanny from Stratford-upon-Avon lived not far from the seedy zoo station, but their address was historic bourgeois Berlin. The street doors were heavy polished oak, and the front staircase wide slippery oak. Their apartment had four balconies. It was an apartment that went on and on around the whole side of the corner building with high ceilings, even in the maid's room where, as I discovered, Cello intended to install me. I tripped over my baby, Cello said when she opened the door. She bounced a shrieking brown toddler with beautiful long curls in her arms as two other gorgeous little honey-colored boys reached up and tried to tickle his toes. Remember peanut brittle, she asked. Her boys had big eyes. I shrugged and Cello cupped the screaming head, turning her baby away from my raised hand. The long sleeveless pale blue satiny dress she wore looked like a nightgown. She had on silk stockings in August and glistening black and white saddle Oxfords with rounded toes. To me, she looked like the music she studied mostly because of her hair. She was a throwback to our great-grandmother's locks, got from some slave master. Instead, we'd say Cherokee. Her hair came from our Indian blood. It was the only thing she had on her sister, her lack of acquaintance with the hot comb. She didn't have to suffer for white girl-like hair. Her nap was soft. She piled her amazingly long, undulating black hair on top of her head or dismissed it over her neck with wide combs. Her attitude toward her hair was as striking as its abundance. Look, okay, I have good hair, as it used to be called in Negro America. Fine, not frizzy, but I'm not going to let it mean anything to me. Otherwise, Cello was the color of a Snickers bar and had a large nose and lips copied from Monterey. She was tall, one of those girls who would have been comforted by the publication of Jackie Onassis's shoe size in the Detroit Free Press. Her ample hips gave her her music camp nickname, which she was instantly proud of. Men noticed her breasts. Her posture was incredible, but her eyes were too small for her face. She did not get her mother's big eyes. She got the raisins of her father's side of the family, my side. Her glasses had to make up for a lot with their style. It was because of her eyes that other women, including her mother, felt that there were other women out there prettier than Cello. That made them generous about her brilliance as a pianist. Their approval lapped at the stairs Cello ascended when in their presence, her hair in her hands, just like the illustration in an old book we had about a princess in trouble. Excuse me. Cello kicked at the tricycle that apparently had been involved in the collision of mother and child. Bad tricycle, she said in German. The older boys started kicking at the various toys that had turned the spacious foyer into a mess. The entrance hall framed three sets of double doors, one set of which opened onto a large salon, also chaotic from child's play. An American fire truck that the children could ride was parked under a long black piano, which seemed to have rolled to rest where it was, not wholly in the corner, blocking the way to another room. Everything in the room felt as if it had been flung there, tables and telephone books and little wooden musical pipes and tiny drums and tiny T-shirts and Beethoven scores and plastic juice cartons with built-in straws. Who are you? The oldest repeated in English. I'm Jed. I was nervous about saying even the simplest things in German to a child, but I again asked him his name. Once more, he didn't reply and hopped away. Otto, Cello said, putting her hollering youngest on the parquet. A hefty young white girl looked out from behind a door. Why aren't you in the kitchen? Where's Hildegard? The rosy-faced brunette scooted back down the corridor, agile in stretch pants she ought not to have had on. Chella lifted her boy again. I just so happened to have been tested while in the rehab. The reason I'd not looked up Chella the last 2 summers I came to Berlin was that she told my mom that she could not have me around her children unless I had the AIDS test. I was secretly relieved not to have her reporting stateside about me, as if people couldn't have seen for themselves had they wanted to. Now Chella was ready to help me in my starting over. She was showing me around the apartment, though I'd been there when they moved in 3 years before. By the end of that visit, I was sweaty in the mirror at the bathroom I kept adjourning to. I was not good enough at anything or good-looking enough to get away with being dirty, she said then. She'd kept me at arm's length since, but Chella was good at wiping the slate clean. You remember where the kitchen is, she said in German. Back in Chicago, I was her cousin, but sometimes in Berlin, she'd made it clear to me that I was her second cousin, a distant family obligation from the United States, a country relation she had to do something for. The boy in her arms and his 6-year-old and 5-year-old brothers trailing us down the hall that let in light from 2 sides were hardly kin to me. Chello handed Maximilian to the nanny and walked me, her mitzvah, past a pantry, a laundry room, and a bathroom. The corridor turned right. We walked through an open door and sat side by side on her on the bed. How she had accumulated shawls on her way down the hall, I couldn't say. She folded 3 or 4 layers of delicate stuff over her bare shoulders. Underneath us, the intricate pattern of a lovely white bed throw. Chello sprang up and ushered the children from the room, telling Otto and Conrad to join their sister and brother at the coloring table in the kitchen. The furniture in the bedroom was on a smaller scale than what I was used to, real Biedermeier with white marble tabletops, the lamps dark Prussian iron. The last time I'd been in that room, there'd been only a camp bed and cartons piled on cartons. I wondered how I was going to ask Chella if I could make some room in the glass case for my own books, which would be arriving soon. I somehow had the feeling that the books had been in that case unexamined for a long time. Every space was taken up. Books were crammed on their sides. Chello didn't read books, not really. She studied scores. Her eyes flashed across bars like a burglar looking at windows for a way in. Yet somehow she had absorbed the vibe of the most important literary works of Western culture. She would have balked to be reminded that her father had this talent. Chello's father was my mom's first cousin. He went nuts in the civil rights movement. Her mother thought she had a singing career, which meant that Chella and her little brother and sister pretty much stayed with us. Chella never could decide what to do with me. After all, I was the only person in West Berlin who'd known her when she was called Ruth Ann, and I'd seen her face during one of her mother's cabaret performances in O-Town in the 1970s. Chella was infinitely more musical than her mother. The gap between them in regard to absolutely everything about music, from degree of talent to the type of music that engaged them, was deeply painful to Chello. It was my mom who called the blind piano tuner, got Chello to lessons, and discussed her next steps with her teachers, and no one more than Chello wanted her mother to be too wrapped up in her own singing lessons and choir practice to pay much attention to Cello's day-to-day development. Chello had a life of her own elsewhere, behind the Temple of the Art Institute, at the American Conservatory of Music, then on to the Chicago Musical College. She was set apart by her destiny. She was not expected to look after her brother and sister. She was never asked to go to the store. Chello never had a child's free time or an adolescent schedule of lassitude behind closed doors. She ate separately, later or earlier, like the poet's slave Phyllis Wheatley in the home of her doting Methodist owners. Then she'd disappear upstairs. Once we'd finished, she liked to help my mom to wash up. We often had my mother's social causes in the form of women bums and female cons staying with us, but Mom didn't like for anyone else to help her to do the dishes except Chello, no matter how many had been at the dinner table. My mom was the person she talked to. Mom was the one in the family who knew the Chopin Fantasy Impromptu when she heard it and just what it would take for Chello to learn it as well as she wanted to. Chello practiced 2 hours a day downtown and then was driven home, where she played some more. But sometimes she sat on Mom's piano bench not playing. She had to take out some of the music stuffed in the seat in order to get it flat. She liked to costume herself in an ankle-length pale blue taffeta gown and sit there, head bowed, hands folded in her lap, lights low. Her gift was her sanctuary. She represented Negro achievement. Whether a National Merit Scholar in high school or a finalist in the Chicago Stokowski Society competition, Negro achievement took her out of the woman's game, out of the black woman's game. She renounced the pleasure other girls live for. Like a sprinter or dancer, she sacrificed everything to the single-minded pursuit of perfection. She was going to give up everything for her art, and because she was a black artist, people around her who didn't understand the music added, her attainments as an artist were also going to count in the freedom struggle. No matter what the disabled club president handing her a modest check said, Cello never pretended that her presence at the Mozarteum was as necessary to the liberation of her people as the registration of black voters in Mississippi. I heard her tell Mom after one such ceremony that she'd managed not to laugh at the way the pastor kept referring to J.S. Bach, not CPE. I didn't get it. She and my mom shared a language I didn't speak. Cello lived on a plane I could never reach. My older brother had his sports zone, which was taken very seriously, but the most anyone ever thought he'd ever get were two chances, high school and college, to say farewell as a varsity player. Cello got away, first to Salzburg, then to Boston, and finally to Berlin. She was the only person I knew who lived in that somewhere else I yearned for, Europe. After all that, she did not have the public career she had prepared for, but nevertheless to the family, especially to her mother, who was afraid of her, she was like somebody famous. She was the wife of a rich white man, not from where we were from, and therefore not bound by our rules. That made it a stinging judgment for Cello to have returned to Chicago only once in 7 years. Most people assumed she'd given up her concert ambitions in order to have children. Cello never said otherwise. She never talked about the calamity of her stage fright. A long time ago, Mom had wagered that if the fat 12-year-old pianist lost weight, she would no longer lose her presence of mind in recital. My mom devoted herself to Cello's problem, and Cello responded by throwing herself into a regimen that murdered the evil twin in her head. Cello wanted the concert stage, and Mom figured out that Cello could shed the pounds holding her back if she had somewhere to treat the matter privately. Private in this case meant somewhere where no one knew her, which was another way of saying where there were no rowdy, hurtful black youths calling her names. That was the bond between us, the reason we only went so far with each other, the knowledge of what it had been like to be a fat black kid at a mostly white school. Mom arranged through a connection on one of her committees for Cello to have private swimming lessons at the medical school. Eat, swim, practice. Eat, school, practice. Eat, practice, sleep. That was why she was excused from meals with us, in order to protect her from the temptations of mashed potatoes. She ate small portions of regulated this and measured that all day long. Her mother couldn't handle a daughter with such special needs, and there were times when Cello came to stay not because things were unstable at home again, but because Mom believed that Cello had a better chance of staying on course under our roof. For plenty of obvious reasons, she binged if around her father and mother for too long. Mom would insist on taking Cello's brother and sister as well. Eat, swim, practice, eat, school, practice, and the more of the same until she made it to sleep. In every room of the house, a clinic of the self was in progress. Mom was a missionary, and we, her children, were an indigenous people. She liked to feel us striving to better ourselves. Television was strictly controlled, but Cello was an altogether different story. The weight loss program worked. It took 5 years, but it worked, and Cello went off to auditions that she and Mom both believed had a chance at last of going well. I'd come a month early to settle in, but really to be alone, to drift down memory's canals while the family was away. But they weren't going on holiday after all. And so for those first 31 days, my beautiful August, I kept family hours. It had not been blue-black for long when I got into bed with a starchy feeling towel. And I got up when I heard the nanny whining all the way from the kitchen about the mess the children were making already. I'd stayed away from the architect's workshop. The new one was still being set up, and they weren't expecting me until September. Rosa Montag wasn't back in Berlin yet. I went to the new state library. Mostly I walked the passageways, train tracks, and dead ends by the river in the old warehouse district northwest of the Reichstag, where Rosa Montag, this architect he's going to work for, was to realize some of his schemes about restoring our living spaces to a human scale. So much of it was off limits and covered up, I couldn't guess what was going on. I was also staying out of the apartment. Cello made no demands on me. She didn't want me too involved with her family. She treated me like a convalescent. She was watching me. I wish she hadn't told her mother-in-law that I was in AA, because brave Frau Schutzberg gave my hand a squeeze when they had me out to Wannsee for Sunday lunch. She was encouraging me not to end up drunk and behind the wheel. I was staying out of the apartment so I wouldn't be smoking in their house. I was free to do so in my room with the window open, but I wanted to impress Cello and her husband that I was doing my part to keep clean the air their children breathed. She'd refused to become pregnant until he quit smoking. Maybe I was also staying out of the apartment in order to be like Dram, a man who came home from work, though I had nothing to do just yet. I, keeping family hours, took a decision out of my hands nightly. I would head around the block for a final cigarette, but come in after 10 minutes. I turned my back on the city of orgies and joy. I was like someone on parole. I was frightened. I was worried enough that the cliches of the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book were true, that I found an AA meeting in English down in the suburb of Dahlem near the U.S. Army base. Soldiers bitched in country accents about their wives. I was afraid not to go to a meeting. Cello's good night on Saturday night after I'd been to a meeting was genuinely warm, I felt. It was true that not to drink could make a drunk feel alone and lost. When I hear recordings of Cecil Taylor live, I am once again downstairs in a West Berlin club, back in the golden age of chain smoking, drinking another glass of white wine in the free zone of staying up all night, talking out the lyric dark and then falling still as his instrument meets the dawning light, the brewing luminosity, Taylor called it. Memory will let in the cool scenes, the hip blowouts. However, the real truth of my summer life in Berlin was held by the plastic interior of a tacky bar. Only the year before, I'd spent whole days and nights in the Shishi Bar, a dive set back from a wide, leafy, deserted street behind the plaza of Europa Center. I'd hung out in the Shishi since my first trip to West Berlin. My fourth night there, I let myself be picked up by a nice French girl, and the night after that, I successfully chatted up a boy from a small West German town. I'd shaken off the sour-smelling old man with the fake ballet russe act. There was a traditional high culture that Cello and Dram lived in, and there was an alternative high culture that I was about to go to work in. But the Berlin I lived in with my soul was around the train station and the porn theaters, the cheap lights and fried food stalls. There were also loud beer bars and serious bookstores tucked under the S-Bahn tracks. I felt at home in a bad bar that did very well. Maybe the Shishi had been in the 70s. It was listed in a gay bar in out-of-date guides, although anybody and everybody could be found there. It hardly mattered because the real business of everyone there was to drink. Addiction insulated the bar against fashion. There was a group of regulars who put in much bar time together. They were the audience for the life-changing mistakes that the Shishi specialized in. It was a place where people experiencing a bad night stayed in to finish things off with meltdowns, blackouts, fistfights, seizures. Sex was just the messy afterthought, something to do when daylight hit. "What time do you close here?" I asked Zippy, the owner, my first night at the Shishi. She lifted her head from the bar. "We are never closed here." In all of my walks when first back in Berlin as a recovering alcoholic, I never let myself go to Europa Center. If I got out at Zoo Station, I took a long roundabout way to Cello's apartment just to avoid going by the old smells and sights, avoid people, places, and things I wanted someone to say at my AA meeting in Dahlem because I'd yet to open my mouth in that meeting. Back up at the center of town, I'd walk with my final cigarette of the day and look down the Ku Dam toward the bright intersection and the street that led up to the train station. I could feel my steps continuing. I always loved the sound of my footsteps in Berlin, the Negro in Europe. I knew they'd be there at the Shishi. It was never too early for Adele to slap a wet towel on the bar, and Zippy to slam the cash register. There was always a fight going on between them. There were always drinks of some kind sitting in front of them. Maybe Big Dash had come in reeking of Indian spices. I could see them, some of whom I'd grope, quiet because it was early yet, drinking fast, their cigarette packs and fancy lighters on the bar, on their way to not needing to drink as fast, and not one of them thinking of me. Alcohol wasn't thinking of me either. You cannot one-up someone who has dumped you, but my former love, white wine, was showing that to be not always the case. I left white wine, yet when I stood there on the Ku Dam with the sky blue behind me and the east ahead of me end of summer dark, it was white wine that was over me already and in the arms of someone else. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Margot Jefferson and Daryl Pinkney for their readings.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you have a question, please raise your hand. We will run a microphone to you. Who would like to start us off?
As someone part of the same time and place as Margot, I just had a comment about the socio-political context of Chicago at that time. Three things. One, white male terrorism. When I moved to the second black family on the block in Chatham, my brother and I were riding our bikes, and we got chased home by 20 white boys on bikes. That was their sense of what was fair. And our bikes were nicer than theirs as well. Two, the way we were all together on our block, houses that had been lived in by working class whites, two-bedroom modest places, were later added to by six-bedroom elaborate houses on the same block when blacks kept moving in. And third, the idea that in our homes, we only saw whites on TV, because the insularity meant that we were, all of our service people, all the professionals, everybody we dealt with was black at that time.
Thank you. There were small variations. Certainly when my family first moved into Hyde Park, it was the same kind of history. For reasons that are unclear to me, though most of the service people were black, we had a white laundryman who delivered the laundry to the back door and was very amiable, but once ran into my mother at Sears Roebuck, where she had gone to buy an appliance. And they saw each other, they were both heading out, and he cut her. He just ignored me. And she came home, and she said, "I saw Wally." And he tried not to speak to me. And she said, "You know, I just go to Sears for appliances, and Wally was there to buy everything. And he's the laundryman, and he comes to the back door, and he still snubbed me." You know, so those little, yeah. It's, Chicago is a treacherous place. The cellos could, you go, in fact, I took music lessons at Chicago Musical College. Yes. So that, you know, yes.
And you went to Interlochen.
I did.
I don't know anything about Chicago, I just made it up, but she does.
Right.
So, what interests me about Negroland is that the time when you were growing up, these black institutions were very strong, and black Chicago was a very strong place.
Yes. Even including, the magazines and the newspaper that are fading in your novel, and were fading by that time.
But your education was a mixed-race experience
beginning. Yes, it was. And actually, that also meant, with tenuousness and tension, there were sometimes white friends in my house, and I was sometimes in their house. It was always it was never as easy as normal, quote unquote, because I think, well, I know the mothers, the parents on both sides were quite anxious, but you're right, that was there, yes.
I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana, which is a whole different deal. My parents used to drive to Chicago to get the newspaper. But I can remember when I was going to school, people were very nice, but the kids who wanted you to come home were Jewish, partly because they didn't know any better and also because they did know better.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly, yeah, that's right.
That's right. And often
the children of immigrants,
yes,
are refugees.
Or survivors.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
I realized that you were very young, but did you know anything about the politics during that time?
Are you talking to me?
Either.
I'll start. Sure. How could you not? You got magazines, you saw television. I was perfectly aware, however I chose to process it, that, my sister and I were going to a white school, a progressive, protected one, but nevertheless that, at the same time, these images of vicious attempts to integrate schools with black children, white schools in the South, were going on. Yeah, we read The Defender, we read Ebony. Yes, you saw Emmett Till's picture in Ebony. Also, parents, this is probably true of your parents too, Daryl. Those dinner party conversations that would suddenly turn to race, you know, and the man, you know, and they don't let us do this, and they don't, and, you know, did you know that, you know, the Pullman porters did such and such. Yeah, this combination of history and grievances and, you know.
I think for us it was a real change because before, I think a lot of black families were determined that the young not go through what they went through and that they kept things from them. But once it was all over the newspapers and everything had changed,
right.
My parents stopped playing bridge in order to become involved in civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I then went into deep denial about the whole thing and just...
As a child, you go in and out of denial. There's no doubt.
I lived in England. Everyone else lived in America, but I lived in England.
Well, you so also get this longing, you know, of the black child to enter some larger, dramatic, you know, extravagant universe. Maybe it's going to New York. Maybe it's going, you know, maybe it's going and living in the East or the West Village,
yeah.
And moving between there and Harlem. Maybe it's going to Europe.
Some place where you were not encumbered by
and yet
this
birthright. Yeah. That's right. And it was there, but it took on many other kinds of meaning, which could be glamorous.
Or difficult.
Yes.
It was always something you had to live up to.
Oh, yes.
That you had to be twice as good just to break even.
Yes, you did.
And that you were always, always representing the race.
And you were always being told that.
And that
Your parents did not shield you from.
No. And that you may be hanging out with so-and-so. But I remember my father was adamant about various things. He said, you cannot hitchhike.
Yes.
Your friends can, but you cannot do it.
That's right.
You really can't.
That's right.
And, you know, all sorts of things.
Boys couldn't hitchhike. Girls in college couldn't waitress, you know, because that would mean you'd be treated. Yeah.
You couldn't make yourself vulnerable to things they were trying to protect you from.
Exactly. To cast, you know, the abuses that come when you are simply viewed as a member of the undercast Negro.
In 2000, I got busted in New York for smoking a joint on the street. I was with two women friends from university, and when they put me in handcuffs, I passed out, you know.
Oh, I know you did.
They put us in the tombs. This is Mayor Giuliani and Zero Tolerance. It was really terrifying. So I wrote something about it, and I had to tell my parents because they had a subscription to this magazine. My father hit the ceiling. You know, I was in my 40s, and he chewed me out for a half an hour.
For being arrested.
You can be arrested for protest, but not for drugs on the street. This was really...
That's right.
He was so disappointed.
Oh, I
mean, really chewed me out.
Appalled and disappointed.
Appalled and disappointed.
Appalled and disappointed.
So it never stopped.
So did literature,
Daryl,
did literature provide you an outlet for these wants and needs that had to be repressed because of, in order to protect yourself?
I refused to read any other book outside of school except The Prince and the Pauper by Mark Twain for a long time. It's the only thing I would read. And then I had an aunt who was visiting, and she had a copy of In Cold Blood lying around. I picked it up, and she didn't take it back, and I thought, whoa.
Something.
I'm missing some things.
Something's happening
here. And so it went
here.
On from that. So yes, reading did. You know, that's why I sort of, when students say, I want to read to identify, I think, well, okay, but read to take a journey.
There is a lot to be said in learning to imagine what has not imagined you.
That's the line from your book.
Yeah, it is. It's true. You must also have the means, you know, to, in fact, imagine yourself, which involves identification in one way, but to imagine what hasn't imagined you, that is also a set of tools and skills, and it's,
Also, black women grow up very differently from black guys, I realized from your book. I mean, I had two sisters, but I never thought about it quite the same way. This kind of inner life of fantasy and yearning, but the constraint to be a nice girl
is like a double for a black girl.
Yeah.
Yes, because you certainly in our time, and I think I've seen some of my students still grappling with this, you were absolutely being raised to combat the, you know, contentious, painful history that, and a history really of myths and stereotypes that had accumulated around black women. The slave legacy of their being, you know, wanton and loose and not knowing how to be good housewives and mothers. Now that sounds a little foolish, but you know, this was an America living with the ideology of the myth of the white womanhood. And womanhood, and it really is descended from Victorian times. You were pure, you were virtuous, you brought a higher moral tone and keener emotions to the family. And you know, history, bogus history, had in fact preached that black women possessed none of the qualities required to be an ideal woman. So while we were supposed to achieve, in a way not unlike men, we were also supposed to achieve this model of white, of Anglo-Saxon upper middle class womanhood.
But also, if black women are depicted as animalistic, it justifies the exploitation of
exactly.
their bodies.
Exactly.
I think Zora Neale Hurston wrote Their Eyes Were Watching God in order to show a black woman capable of romantic love without lasciviousness.
That
at
is,
a time when
yes.
that's all there was.
I think that's absolutely yeah. right. She had a mind, an intelligence, a body, all of the above. And she made
and
choices.
No children.
And she made choices about her husbands yeah. more and more yeah. as she went along. Yeah. And no children, yes.
There's a question in back on the right here.
What inspired you to write this book? What should I come away from with it, you know, by reading it? You know, the importance of understanding the story. What inspired you to write it, and what do you want your readers to come away from after reading this book?
I want them to have had a pleasurable experience just reading. It's fiction, but it contains the truth of my feeling for Berlin. In the time of the wall, it was a very special, artificial, subsidized, free zone kind of paradise. I think what I want people to think about is just this very memorial to the city that won't come back. Probably, it took me a long time to realize that the freedom of Berlin depended on the unfreedom of a lot of people around it. So is that. And then, Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison chose Russian literature as their 19th century antecedents because they thought 19th century American literature was just too racist. But Russian literature had all the same themes of serfs and identification with Europe and things like that. So these kind of rootless narrators from Dostoevsky were as much on my mind when I wrote this as the black autobiographical tradition. So you write to honor the books you love yourself.
Yep,
so you just want someone to think, oh, what a weird book that needs me. You know, I'll read it.
The complexity of all these cultural and emotional and geographical needs and visions, and you know, they're all meshing and layering. This is interesting. This is important. It matters.
Just a question for Professor Jefferson.
Yeah.
I wonder if you've gotten any commentary from members of other racial or ethnic background regarding similarities or similar experiences that they encountered in their upbringing, whether such commentary might have been surprising or not regarding their upbringing in whatever upper middle or upper income class they might have belonged to.
I have, and I think it is these constant tensions between and oscillations between and race in my case. It could certainly be ethnicity, religion, you know, whatever, and gender. I particularly hear this from women. And class. It's that network, that nexus, and how they stand in for each other and overlap and sometimes mask each other. Yes, and it didn't entirely surprise me because, you know, friends I have had over the years from, you know, other groups, we've talked about this. You know, that was a legacy of certain kinds of truths and honesty, and that, you know, began to open up more in 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. So not shocking, but interesting. You know, what directions it comes from, and what matters most, what stings most in people's memories. It's moving to me. As long as we, you know, keep clear about the distinctions and the subtleties and differences, it's moving to me that people bring their own memories and imaginations and factual memories to this and come at it in different ways, from different angles.
Well, we're only getting started, but unfortunately we have to end. Please join me in thanking Margo Jefferson and Daryl Pinkney.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.